Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Jack Spencer and John Rurink. A little later, Bob Wilson from the Michigan Trailways Association. First, guys, we had a heck of a week with the gubernatorial debates, the first one being in Grand Rapids on the Republican side, the second one being Thursday, I guess more technically a forum with all seven Republican and Democratic candidates. And I think it's fair to say, Jack, that Bill Schuette was the recipient of some aggressive attacks by Brian Kelly on both debates. The first one saying that there isn't anything Bill Schuette won't say or do to be governor, and then the second one, the revelations about him managing Virgin Island land from his late mother and being the beneficiary of said transactions. At what point do these things take their toll on Bill Schuette, if they do at all?
I think they take a certain toll, and I think that Kelly seems to be the one that's clearly the aggressor on these things. And it was probably somewhat of a good week for Kelly, I thought, and less so for Schuette as being the leader who was targeted. Again, it depends on, you know, how far ahead is Schuette, really? You know, can he take these kinds of hits in a week? Probably. Do they take enough luster off him, you know, to actually have an effect on the in the long run? Well, I think Brian Kelly would have to have more good weeks to follow it up. But I think all in all, I do think Schuette kind of came out with the sense that he is the one who is treading water at the moment a little bit, whereas Kelly and maybe indirectly the other candidates kind of had a better week.
I think last week was actually a demonstration of exactly what was wrong with the Bill Schuette strategy of avoiding these early gubernatorial forums. I think there was so much pent-up demand on the part of Kelly to score a point. He's still far behind in the polls. It was the first opportunity in a face-to-face to actually, you know, lay a glove on him. So you knew he was going to get some pounding done to him. And I think had he participated in these earlier forums, some of this stuff might have come out. I think when you've had that first gubernatorial forum that you did a very good job moderating, by the way.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it.
When you had that first forum, I think it would have been much more of a polite exercise had Schuette participated in these earlier events.
I think it would have been less rusty had he participated in those prior debates too, the ones in January and February and March. And it would have been less attention, I think, as far as the public's concerned. But I also think that he would have worked some of the bugs out. Bill Schuette's been in politics for 30 years now. He's no stranger to this, but there's a certain amount of practice that comes with it. You know, I can hit a softball too, but if I haven't done it in a few months and then I go out there and try and hit it, my first one isn't going to be that good, right? So I think there's something to be said for him going out earlier and having participated in these debates. He just didn't do it, Jack. And I think what also it shows is that after being in politics for 30 years, there's a lot of things that Brian Kelly or anybody else could hit him on.
Well, yes, there is, and you make a real good point about him not being in those other town halls and debates, because maybe the thought was, well, he's been a politician for all these years, so it's just another debate, like he's been doing it, so it'll be secondhand. Well, obviously, it wasn't secondhand to him. And I thought I was kind of amazed that the Virgin Islands thing and his wealth, he had that much trouble with. I mean, I don't know why that would never have crossed their minds ahead of time that somebody wouldn't bring that up.
At some point, right? And maybe not at that debate or the debate before, but at some point, someone is going to bring up the fact that, hey, you've been managing this estate that is worth millions of dollars, and it's never been really brought up. I guess it shouldn't be a surprise, I suppose. I'd never heard of it, and I guess I'd never really thought of it before.
In a way, though, I mean, I can understand he kind of got caught flat-footed. But on the other hand, what occurred to me while I was watching this after the fact and when they released the details about what this was, why he couldn't have just simply said, you know, my sisters and I are dealing with an estate from my stepfather, property that he left us, and we're trying to get rid of it. I mean, you could have said that to the reporters. I think it would have dampened it way down. I think there was so much excitement because he stammered and couldn't really answer and kind of denied he owned any property and then said, well, I'll have to look into it. And it was like, it was a moment for reporters where you're like, there's something here. Mm-hmm. Now, he's just not answering a very simple question. He should have been able to say, It's an estate issue. You know, my mother married a very wealthy man. He left us some property. We're in the process of trying to get rid of it.
The other thing that we're left with from what happened last week, Jack, is this continuous idea about whether Bill Schuette is using the Attorney General's office in the way that he should be using it. And I think this is a continuous theme that we're going to hear. In the follow-up stories that came out of this debate, it was Bill Schuette using his staff to sign these legal documents for his personal land dealings, and whether that was proper. And I think that follows the other revelations that we heard about how he brought in folks who were political operatives to go out and advance the name of Bill Schuette. This is another thing that I think going forward that Brian Kelly and maybe the Democrats could use to their advantage.
Yes, they could use it to their advantage, and yet here in the immediate radius of the Capitol, it's like, well, of course he brings people in that are later going to be helpful right. on a campaign. But that doesn't play that way out with the overall audience as far as the voters go. And again, to me, these are the things, though, if you really stop and think about it, these are things he and his campaign should have expected and been ready to respond to. And I'm not real sure they've done a great job of responding to it yet.
I thought Jim Hines actually responded the best to it by saying, geez, Brian, you're one to talk. You're the one who created this Clean Michigan Government campaign, never told anyone how you were funding it. The disclosures were very murky at best. And by the way, you hired a felon to help collect the signatures for it. He had the best response out of everybody.
Oh, yeah, I thought he had a very good political response. He saw an opportunity, he took it, and good for him.
Yeah, Bill Schuette's campaign has been kind of caught flat-footed here. Maybe kind of speaks to the prevent defense that they're playing at this point.
Well, when you're in fourth place, they're all ahead of you, and you've got to chip away at all of them. So it's not right. surprising that Hines would be the one to do that. But it was a well-worded statement.
One of the things that kind of makes me wonder about is whether the consultants in and around Bill Schuette are comfortable sort of working through his background with him and asking the tough questions about what might come out and how you're going to handle the responses. Sometimes you get a leader like Schuette's been around for a long time and the people around him aren't comfortable sort of poking holes at him, but that has to happen. It's part of the process.
Well, that's a good point, because you know that clearly Brian Kelly's done some background research in Bill Schuette, and it'd be curious to know if Bill Schuette has done background research into Bill Schuette.
And consultant kind of take a whack at him. You know, hey, you do have all this money. What are the weak spots somebody could hit you with? And how are you going to respond if those come? And that's an important part of the campaigning process.
And because if it's not coming out in a debate format, it will come out in a special report by this outlet or that news outlet or whatever. I mean, the Sri Tanadar stuff that came about with the beagles and the monkeys, that didn't come out in a debate. That came out in a Huffington Post article, right? So these things will come out through whichever median, and it's how you respond. But speaking of Sri, I think we've seen the bottom of the bucket here for Sri Tanadar. He's not billions of dollars of wealth here. Him deciding not to continue with this ad buy that he's currently been operating under, Jack, shows me that money is going to be a factor for him going forward.
Yes, and you do wonder if there was simply an amount that he had set aside, and this is how much I'm going to spend over this certain period of time. And with these kind of candidates, the first time they're in, what always crosses my mind, is this the one they actually think they can win, or are they looking ahead to a couple years or something down the line? And first you've got to get your feet wet, and I've run before, and here's what I've learned when I ran. And I do wonder about that, if this is okay, I did this right, I did this wrong, and if this is where he spent the amount of money that he planned on spending to begin with.
How much does this hurt him, John? I mean, it seems like his name idea is pretty high up there. I don't know if it could get much higher. Maybe it does. I don't know.
I don't think it hurts him much if it's a short pause. I mean, you remember, we're 2 weeks away from sort of the kickoff of the summer season where people really start to stop paying attention. If he's only stopping through the holiday and starts right back up and really ramps it up going up into the primary, then I don't think it hurts him at all. But if it's an extended blackout, he's done. If he's done spending, he's probably done.
One more thing that I want to touch on, the beagles and the monkeys. Are we going to see this in a campaign ad, yes or no?
Yes.
John, you think we're going to see it?
Oh, probably.
Who's going to do it? Will it be Abdul or will it be a Gretchen Whitmer associated pack?
I think it's an associated group supporting Whitmer.
Okay. I would tend to agree with you.
I think the Whitmer people maybe, I would say they'd probably hesitate a little bit and see if Abdul can do the dirty work for him. Why not let him do it?
Right. And see what the polling looks like in late June, July, and see if they feel like they got to soften them up a bit. Because right now, nobody's laid a glove on Shree as far as like the paid media aspect of things. I mean, the news media, earned media type stuff, that has really been hurtful to Shree as far as the Beagles and the Monkees. But wait till you get the paid media. Wait till you do some dramatization and you use those old news clips. And
those commercials where they're raising money to prevent animal abuse and they show those poor dogs with tears in their eyes in the cages.
Did you guys happen to see Abdul El-Sad's Facebook page about how he did this and that for animals when he was at the city of Detroit and the public health director, and he was helping all those pets and everything, and pictures of him and the dogs?
It's great. You can't hurt yourself by looking like you're a friend of the animals.
It just warms your heart, really.
Everybody really should take a few minutes this week and hug an animal of some kind or another.
I've got two rescue dogs. I'm qualified to be your governor.
All right, well, with that, let's bring in Bob. It's time we all reach out for something new. That means you too. You say you want a leader, but you can't seem to make up your mind. Joining us now for the podcast is the Executive Director of the Michigan Trails and Greenway Alliance. He is Bob Wilson. He's no stranger to these parts. And Lansing, thanks for joining us, Bob.
Sure. I'm glad to be here to spent a little time talking about Patty Burkholz and the great things that she accomplished in their 8 years as a state senator.
Well, let's set a little groundwork here. Yeah. Tell us how you got to know Patty and a little bit about your background.
Sure. So I started in 1989 when John Engler was the majority leader, and I was the policy advisor for the Senate Republican Caucus. So I worked with 8 different Senate majority leaders in the 28 years that I was in the Michigan Senate. And I got a chance to know Patty because she was the chair of the Natural Resources Committee for 8 years while I was in the Senate. And just prior to that time, I had actually worked directly for Ken Sikkema as the chair of the Natural Resources Committee. So my familiarity with Patty is based on my role as the advisor to the Natural Resources Committee during that time.
Wow, so you worked for the Senate for almost 30 years. That's almost unheard of these days.
Yeah, it was it was a really interesting 28 years spent working on policy and politics. And I learned in the 28 years there that many times politics will trump policy. But the cool thing about Patty is that policy always drove her agenda.
Now, of course, Patty Burkholz died a couple weeks ago. Let's just get what you felt when you heard the news.
Well, I was stunned. Patty and I had lost contact with each other for the last few years when she came on board as one of the policy people at the League of Conservation Voters. Prior to that time, I'd actually worked pretty closely with her when she was the head of the Office of the Great Lakes. So I really, when she left the Senate in 2010, lit a bit of interface when the Office of the Great Lakes, but really the last couple of months had no knowledge of her health situation until Amanda Price gave me a call and said that Patty had been moved into hospice. So at that point, I was very aware of what was going on.
Amanda Price, former state representative, was a top aide for Patty Burkholz.
Yeah, there were two principals in her office that I worked directly with, Sally Durfee, the chief of staff, and then Amanda Price, who was more focused on legislative issues. So, yes, I worked with both Patty and Sally. And actually, Sally reached out to me at the same time that Amanda did as well about Patty's situation.
So what made Patty Burkholz unique?
Well, first of all, I tell everyone that she was a gatherer of good people. Patty was not afraid, and in fact, very willing to bring good people into her office, into her shop, to fashion policy. And it didn't matter what political persuasion that they were. She loved people that were willing to work, that had good technical expertise, and were committed to good policy. So she was unique. I mean, Ken Sikkema was a lot like that as natural resources chair. But Patty was even more passionate about natural resources issues. You knew where her heart was at all times. And she would cut through all sorts of political riffraff to get to the policy issue. She had a goal in mind, and she was driven by that goal.
Now, that's kind of unique for Republicans. You don't really think of an environmentalist being a Republican, but she really, really was, wasn't she?
Totally. When Patty came on board as Natural Resources Chair, I was so excited because I was probably more of a policy person than a political person. And for the first number of years I was working in the Senate, I would have to cut through some of the political folks to kind of get a few issues done. But with Patty, we had the same agenda to go after a conservation-based approach to policy. So it was, yeah, it was a great time for all of us who believed in conservation during that 8 years that she was chair.
To sort of get out there a little bit, what one thing did she accomplish that, sitting here today, you think that's going to be a legacy thing in 10 years, in 20 years?
I would say the Great Lakes Basin Compact. The work she did on the compact and the water withdrawal assessment tool that was the first step once the compact had been negotiated. So on the compact, each state had the requirement of setting up a water regulatory scheme. And rather than waiting until after the compact, we did the compact at the same time, worked on the water withdrawal assessment tool. Very much a science-based approach to managing water withdrawals in Michigan. So combining those two efforts, and I remember when we started working on a campaign, we brought all the interest groups into a room twice the size, and there were probably 50, 60 people around the table, all had different issues to discuss when it came time to implement the compact. It's very difficult. We didn't know how we were going to put our arms around all those folks and all those diverse interests. Patty was able to, working with Amanda and Sally and I, were able to put together some subcommittees that eventually narrowed the range of issues down where we could get something done. So I think the compact, and then the other thing, the other legacy issue that everyone mentions, and that's the recreation passport. We were in a situation where our funding for our state parks was declining. We lacked general fund. We didn't have the park admission revenue coming in. So our parks were on the verge of failure. We needed a new system, and Patty reached out to the State Parks Advisory Committee, who had a number of recommendations, and we chose the Montana model for the recreation passport. So I think those two issues were kind of legacy issues for all of us.
And our parks now, we're good?
Yeah, they're. I mean, we still need significant funding for decaying infrastructure. That's why we have the State Park Endowment Fund. But we have a pretty good source of funding through the recreation passport. Now, the recreation passport ideally should be an opt-out approach like Montana. We're an opt-in, and there's some talk about trying to shift over to that approach within the next few months, potentially. It's one of the issues that we're working on.
Now, one of the things that I hauled out for our interview is this Great Lakes Conservation Task Force report that now you're telling me you were actually the writer.
Well, Senator Sycamore was the chair of the Natural Resources Committee, and we sat down in his office and said, Bob, I want to go around the state and get a sense for the different emerging issues that impact our Great Lakes. So we actually charted out, I think there were 6 or 7 or 8 different public hearings we held around the state. And Ken had me sort of be the scribe for that report, recording testimony, researching, coming up with ideas. So the report that we ended up fashioning was released in 2002, is a series of recommendations that the committee cobbled together. And I actually wrote the report on behalf of Senator Sycamore.
This is like 80 pages.
Yeah. It was so cool because it was. And I thought, how in the world am I going to get all these ideas into report? And what we ended up doing is we took public testimony, and every person who testified at those public hearings, their name is in that report. So the report is actually their report. And I just tried to get the common issues that came out in the different public hearings and made these recommendations that eventually became the blueprint for Ken's committee and then eventually for Patty's committee in terms of the compact and aquatic invasive species and how you deal with ballast water and
other. You just proved you're a policy geek. You got giddy about an 80-page report.
Oh, yeah. it was so cool. I mean, really, I was daunted, intimidated by the prospect of how to write this report. But as it sort of filled in, I thought, wow, what a cool opportunity. And then the unique thing about it was that you had a chair of the Natural Resources Committee, Ken Sumgood at the time, who was committed to that. And then Patty came on board taking Ken's position. Ken became the majority leader. So you had the majority leader endorsing this and a committee chair who loved these recommendations. That's one of the reasons we got done about 2/3 of the recommendations in that report, is that you had a majority leader leadership approach supporting it, and then you had a committee chair who carried forward a lot of these ideas.
Now, how many recommendations are in here?
I think there's 88 recommendations.
Wait, 88 recommendations in this thing.
Yeah.
And you guys got done 2/3 of them.
We were up to around 50 or 60 by the time Ken left office as majority leader. And every time he would do a sort of a state of the legislative report, and he would always bring up the sort of the scorecard in terms of what it is we were doing for this committee, and he would check off the items. We got this done. So really, you know, in a time when many times you write reports and they don't lead to much, this report is policy-based, actually led to a lot of legislative acts.
Was there a recommendation in there that she wished she really would have gotten? I mean, was there anything you left on the table that you know,
I don't think so. I mean, we got the major items done. And one of the first things Patty worked on was this aquatic invasive species issue. We realized that the number one vector for introducing AIS in the Great Lakes Basin was ballast water from ocean-going vessels. So the first bill that she began to work on is how to regulate ballast water, and we came up with this regimen that we have in place today.
Is Line 5 in here?
There's some discussion about oil and pipelines within the Straits of Mackinac. Mm-hmm. And the report actually makes a recommendation about additional state oversight over the utility pipelines in the Straits of Mackinac. So yeah, it was back then it wasn't nearly as prominent an issue, but we did talk about the fact that there's a dual oversight between the feds and the state of Michigan over those facilities. And we urged actually more oversight.
Yeah, look at that. Here it is, page 50. There should be a complete review of pipeline safety, monitoring and inspections by the Michigan Public Service Commission. Did they end up doing that? Was that end up later?
Yeah, I think they had. They ended up doing that. They made some foray into the issue, but probably not as significant as what we had contemplated.
Looking back then at this report and the fact that Patty was the chair of this, is it because she was chair that you guys were able to get two-thirds of this thing through?
Yeah, I think, you know, I would say that Ken Sikkema's support for that. Mm-hmm. And when Patty would give her legislative agenda, things she wanted to accomplish over the next few years, Ken would weigh in and say, we think that's consistent with the report. So I think it was a combination, a partnership between Patty and Ken that actually led to getting a lot of this done. And if you look at the report, it's a bipartisan report. Byron was on the committee, Gary Peters was on that committee. So you had a lot of support from the other side of the aisle. And these were all written in a time when maybe there's a little bit more work across the aisle. So, you know, you got to have, and we had a Democratic governor at the time. So sometimes Governor Granholm was faulted for not having a strong an environmental agenda. And we had an opportunity to sort of help her craft that agenda because Patty and the governor were good friends, along with Rebecca Warren, too.
So in closing here, we only got a couple minutes left, but you don't see much like her anymore, do you?
No, I don't. She had a solid conservation soul. She firmly believed in protecting our natural resources. She was passionate about it. The nice thing about Patty is how civil she was. She could walk into a room, make friends with folks, sort of soft-pedal issues, begin to cobble together that alliance, those relationships that actually led her to getting a lot of policy done. So I equate her a lot with people like Joe Schwartz, just good common sense, relationship building people that you are not afraid to work with. That's her legacy from my perspective.
You know, I never knew the story about the purple until Rick Jones told it to me.
I had no knowledge either.
Is that right? You didn't know the story either?
Completely surprised by it. I just figured that, like my mom, who has a special color, that Patty had purple as her special color. I had no knowledge of the source of that. So I didn't want to comment on that because it was completely stunning to me. But I just appreciated the fact that she was so, it was so amazing for her to cobble together an outfit every day that had purple in it. Just, you know, wow. And she always looked real sharp, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Come to find out her true love had gotten her a purple amethyst.
I had no knowledge of that. I didn't want to comment.
No, of course not. But
yeah.
Very, very interesting and the reason for the closing music here. Well, Bob Wilson, thanks a lot for coming in here today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Kyle. Really appreciate it.
And that's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Mondays. Thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. For John Roerink, Jack Spencer, I'm Kyle Mullen. Until next week, take care.